Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin our show by taking a look at democracy in the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. Glad to have with me today Sid Robinson. Sidney is an architect. He works with Taliesin Preservation Incorporated. He is an emeritus professor of architecture at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Has done, obviously, a lot of work with the Wright people, has studied Wright's work for a long, long time, and is also going to be telling us about a great event that's coming up this Saturday that's going to highlight a lot of Wright's work and a chance for you to get involved, and maybe you'll want to come and take part in the tours, the lecture, and the panel of experts who will be discussing Wright and his work. And we'll fill you in on the details of that as we move along today. You may be a supporter of Frank Lloyd Wright's work, or maybe not. Maybe you don't like his work. It's hard to imagine not liking his work in many instances. For me, I've always enjoyed it. You can join in with your own comments or questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR with a question, or just go to our website, our Facebook page, excuse me, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment there. Maybe you've taken a photo of a Wright home. Maybe you live in a Wright home. You want to join in. Give us a call. Shoot us a Facebook message. We'd love to hear from you. And Sid Robinson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Larry.
It's great to have you with us today to talk about Frank Lloyd Wright and to talk about this great event that sounds like coming up on Saturday. But Wright, well, he worked in Chicago at Oak Park, Illinois, and Madison and Spring Green and Arizona, and he designed buildings around the world.
Yes.
Did he not? But his connection to Wisconsin, I think, is really special. Tell us about that.
Well, we have to remember that he was born here.
Yeah.
And he always considered Wisconsin home, even if he were in Tokyo or London or the Southwest. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin was home. And I think what he felt he brought to architecture had its roots here in Wisconsin, particularly in the area around his mother's family's farms in around Spring Green.
Yeah. And Taliesin is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, is it not? What goes on there today?
Yes. Well, Taliesin has is a unique example of Frank Lloyd Wright's work because the architecture and the life that's lived within it are so tightly intertwined that it gives you a good example of what he thought the relationship between buildings and people ought to be. And Taliesin has gone through many changes. It was built in 1911 and as a retreat for Wright and his paramour, Mamma Borthwick. Then it became a working an office because obviously he had to leave Chicago under a cloud and the mm-hmm. and the fires in 1914, and then when he met his third wife Olga Vanna, it became a very self-conscious community called the Taliesin Fellowship, and then after that. After Wright died in 59, that was carried on, and it had an architectural office, and now that has ceased operation. And now, at this 100th year anniversary, we are at a very interesting transition point to decide what is the relationship, Taliesin, between the past, the present, and the future, because things are changing.
Things are changing. I want to maybe talk about that. But when you see Taliesin in those rolling hills of Spring Green, you get such a strong sense of the organic style of architecture, I think, that marks his work, does it?
Yes. Well, and that word organic is a pretty good We like to call words like that onion words because you keep peeling them off and you get layer after layer. And there's no question that Taliesin itself represents probably the high point of that integration of life and architecture. And I think one of the elements that's so important when we think about organic architecture is the presence of time. Buildings change as life changes, or they should. I've often spoken to students. There's only one building type where what goes on inside the building and the building never go out of alignment, and that's a mausoleum. Because the people are dead and the building is dead. But if you have people living in a structure, it has to adapt over time. Yeah. And that's one of the challenges working for Taliesin Preservation, is to figure out what is the responsibility and the relationship between a historical object, which we can learn from as an object in the past, and the life that can make use of it in the present.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of people, I assume, working on that.
Yes, exactly. We have a crew of six or eight people who are constantly working on the buildings, because any house needs maintenance, particularly a 100-year-old house, and so there's continuous activity on working on the building. Yes,
I know Ray and Wausau worked and lived around Taliesin, and we'll hear from him in just a minute. But I'm interested in how you were introduced to Taliesin those many years ago.
Well, yes, my father was an architect in Ann Arbor, and he was had books on Frank Lloyd Wright. So as a kid, I looked at these. And then I went to work for Alden Dow, who was an architect in Michigan, who had been an apprentice in 1933. And as I went through my decision of careers, I ended up going from being a full-time architect to being a teacher and a writer. And I asked Alden Dow if he would introduce me to Mrs. Wright in the early 70s. So I was able to arrive at Taliesin one morning, and they said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Robinson, you'll probably be staying over where the apprentices are. We'll go tell Mrs. Wright you're here." And they went into the house and came back with a sort of stunned look on their face, because Mrs. Wright said I would be staying in the house, which was a singular honor, which I came to realize, because they, for the next 3 or 4 days, they were trying to figure out who in the world I was. I was just the representative of a very wealthy man, was the point.
You had a great letter of reference.
I did, yes.
Well, Ray and Wausau, let's go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, back in the 80s, I was fortunate to live at Hilltop, which was across from Taliesin. A man by the name of Herb Fritz owned it, and he was also a student of Frank Lloyd Wright. I also was friends with the Carraways. He was also a student of Frank Lloyd Wright. I also did tours. I worked there periodically, volunteered, and I have traveled all over the world, and I have seen a lot of amazing architecture, but Frank Lloyd Wright definitely has the only key to architectural organic evolution that I think is fully connected with the land, using materials, philosophy, psychology, anthropology. I mean, those are a lot of wordy explanations, but if you look at the whole picture of it, and you look at the history and the evolution of evolved and the people involved with it and the components of how certain society and architecture and communities have evolved past that, it was amazing. And most people don't realize Frank Lloyd Wright reinvented himself completely past the age of 60.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling, Ray. Comments, Sid?
Well, I appreciate his observation about the comprehensiveness of Frank Lloyd Wright's view of architecture and life. And I think that's one of the things that makes him enduring, is because he didn't just address a single moment with a single idea. He actually had an approach, a way of integrating a number of forces and features in people's experiences and lives that have allowed his buildings to maintain their significance and to allow people to learn from that comprehensive view.
Absolutely. And, you know, we were talking, I mentioned sort of in the title or the introduction here, we were going to talk about democracy in the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. And that term democracy, I think about that now. How do we get democracy? I think democracy related to the his idea about inventing an American architecture, is that the essence?
Well, exactly. And he really followed on his mentor, Louis Sullivan, in Chicago. There was a great interest at the beginning of the 20th century of trying to free up American culture generally from the models and the weight of European examples. And so there was an effort to try and see, well, what does it mean to be an American poet or painter or architect? And this notion of democracy was something that he learned from Walt Whitman Emerson and Thoreau and so on. And he was trying to find a way to make it architectural. And I think that was a pretty significant step on his part. And I think the way he thought about democracy was he felt that democracy was giving the individual the freedom to be uncommon. He did not see democracy as lockstep sameness. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, it's a very subtle interpretation of what democracy might mean, because if you are free to be uncommon, then you are sticking out from the crowd, so to speak. And Wright certainly enjoyed standing out from the crowd. And his celebration of the individual and the individual's right to do that is certainly one of the things that he thought his buildings would be able to accomplish.
Yeah. Thanks again, Ray, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Annette in Grant County a chance to participate. Annette, hello to you. Arlene.
Arlene, thank you so much. Thank you for giving me some time. I wanted to let you know is that Grant County Historical Society is going to have a special event on Frank Lloyd Wright on the weekend of September 10th and 11th. And what is exciting about this is that Frank Lloyd Wright designed a home for people that he actually knew and his family knew as they were growing up. And it's the Kinney Residence in Lancaster. And what's exciting about this event is that the family has opened up this home for people to visit. Beside tours, there's going to be a special presentation by Tim K. Wright on the evening of the 10th. And he is the grandson of Frank Lloyd Wright, and he will be traveling from Pennsylvania and then into Wisconsin and finally to Lancaster. Also featured are Rob Jakovich and Ann Kinney, who grew up in the Frank Lloyd Wright home. So that is taking place, and I thought your audience would be interested in what is going on. We will be putting it on our website, but if people are interested in tickets, I have a couple numbers that they could call.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, why don't we get have Judith get those numbers, and we'll just post them up on our Facebook page. How's that?
That would be great, but I just thought, what a wonderful tie-in for all of this to happen during this special centennial year.
Oh, absolutely. Tell you what, we're going to put you on hold, and we'll get that information from, I'll have Judith get that information, and then we will post it on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show so people can learn about it. And I want to talk, and maybe we'll take a call from Corrine in Richland Center, and then I also want to talk about the other event that's coming up this weekend. So it's coming up before the September 10th event. We'll do that in just a minute. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sidney Robinson, architect, works with Taliesin Preservation Incorporated, as we talk about the work, the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest architect, Sidney Robinson. Sid knows a lot about the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, and great to have him with us today as we talk about Wright's work. And Sid, I'm pretty sure Corrine was talking from Richland Center about Arlene was talking about the event in Lancaster in September on the 10th. You're quite familiar with
yes.
that.
Yes.
With that event as well. And it should be a good one.
Yes, it should.
Corrine in Richland Center. Now we go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
All right. Now, about a week ago, we had a tourist that took us around town to point out the various residences of VIPs from this city. Well, when he got to the Frank Lloyd Wright warehouse, the A.D. German warehouse, he announced that it has been sold. Within 90 days, things will be progressing, and we may have a lot of buzz going around this town, but we're all excited.
Sid, are you familiar with this?
Oh, yes. Excellent. That is very good news to know that this glacier is moving again because it's a unique example of Wright's architecture and poses some interesting challenges, as I was referring earlier, to the relationship between a static building and a living world around it, and trying to find a new connection between the two is something that people have been hoping for at the German warehouse for a long time. So this is good news.
So is the building going to move, or is it?
No. It will be as we say in the architect biz, it will be repurposed.
All right. Corrine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments about Frank Lloyd Wright and his work at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or shoot us a note on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. We can get you on pretty quickly here. You know, he was he had many wonderful home projects, and I think he really, although he has some great non-home architecture, he zeroed in a lot on homes, did he not, over his life?
Yes, and I think that's when relating it to the theme of democracy, one of the predecessors that he thought highly of was Thomas Jefferson, and we remember what Thomas Jefferson's view of America, as he imagined it, as a Southern plantation owner, was not an industrial metropolis, but a nation of yeoman farmers. And so the notion of America being related to its land, which Wright was very sensitive and gifted in interpreting, he really thought that a democratic society began and was and rested on a highly developed individual. That was the stuff of which democracy was made, and so the important first step was to create environments for individuals and families to achieve that status and then participate in the body politic as time went on. So he did do public buildings, there's no question about that. And he really thought of many of them as sort of extended family buildings. If we think of his two sort of corporate headquarters, the Larkin Building in Buffalo, which has been torn down, and the S.C. Johnson headquarters in Racine, there is a sense in which those are not just bureaucratic structures, but they're actually sort of large homes in the sense that everyone is related to a common purpose. And I think that was important to Wright.
Yeah, and very important. One place I would love to visit is Falling Water in Pennsylvania. And as a matter of fact, I see Judith has done us a nice favor here and posted a nice photo of Falling Water on our Facebook page. If you want to see what Falling Water looks like, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you'll see a really nice shot of it. I believe she took it a couple of years ago. He's got visited a couple of years ago. Just tell us about that house for a
minute. Well, I actually was there 2 weeks ago. So.
Oh, okay.
and Falling Water, of course, is a dramatic building. There's no question that Frank Lloyd Wright loved drama in the way he often behaved and the way he dressed with his cape and so on. And this building is probably the most famous building because of its dramatic sighting on top of the waterfall. And it's a fascinating story because it was done, as the first caller mentioned, sort of his second career in his 60s, that this was a building that, in a sense, was an answer to architects in Europe. This question of what is modern architecture was something that consumed various architects, and Wright himself was interested in claiming his primacy in that realm. But he thought the Europeans, in a way, were getting out ahead of him, and and they were interested in flat white bands and windows all in a row, and so Frank Lloyd Wright said, "Well, I'll use those elements that you in Europe have been misusing, and I'll show you how to do it." And so he applied some of the stylistic traits of that 20s and 30s European modernism and produced a building which is about as far away from their architecture as you could get, even though it has elements in common with them.
Is it possible to visit Falling Rock?
Oh, yes. They have a very active tour program there. And in fact, they during the summer, they really pump them through that building, which is a relatively small house. It's fortunate the landscape is open as well, so you can wander around and go to the place that picture is taken from. There's a path that takes you to the view, and that's the view.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, talking about looking at Wright's work, there is going to be an opportunity this Saturday to tour some of his work, and kind of a big event from 11 to 4 in Madison. And can you tell us about that event, Sid?
Well, yes, that was an opportunity that a series of anniversaries suggested. It's the 100th year of Taliesin. It's the 75th year of one of Wright's, I think, one of his most important buildings, which is the Usonian house type. The first one was built here in Madison in 1936 by Herbert Jacobs, Jacobs One House. And then it's the 60th anniversary of the first Unitarian Society of Madison meeting house. And so you have two houses that will be looked at on Saturday, plus the communal building of the meeting house. And the theme is that Frank Lloyd Wright was, as has been mentioned earlier, was very interested in an American architecture, which didn't mean just wealthy Americans, but people of moderate means. And so from very beginning in his career, he was interested in housing, finding ways to design and produce houses that would have a formal architectural sophistication, but would also be available in terms of price. So he began one of his biggest projects, which didn't really go anywhere, was the American System Built Housing Project. There are houses on Burnham Street in Milwaukee that are being restored. Then the Usonian Project in the mid-30s. And then in the 50s, after working with Marshall Erdman, building the first Unitarian meeting house, developed some prefabricated houses for Marshall Erdman. I think one of the interesting things that we'll be able to see on Saturday is a house that Marshall Erdman himself produced and Wright used as a basis for one of his designs, which shows the kind of relationship that Wright and Marshall had with each other. There was a mutual respect and admiration, I think, on both sides.
So those tours, and then there's an opening lecture
Yes. The minister, Michael Schuller, at the Unitarian Society and I will be opening the event on Saturday at 11 o'clock at the meeting house, talking from two perspectives about Wright's interest in democracy and how that might have affected his buildings. Then the houses will be open at people's leisure. In other words, they can go and we'll give them a map and they can go and find them. And then we regroup at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon for a panel discussion with Jack Holtz-Cedar, who was very familiar with the Right in Wisconsin activities, mm-hmm. and the Burnham Street, myself and Jim Dennis, who owns the First Jacobs House, to talk about what it's like to live in a Right house.
And I know Judith has posted information on how to sign up for this, although I think you can sign up right on site. But if you are able to purchase advance tickets by noon on Thursday, there's a box lunch that's included. Later registrations and walk-ins are certainly welcome. But if you can do it by Thursday noon, it's $35 either way. But Thursday noon, there's also a box lunch that's included. It's a very reasonable price, I think, for 5 hours of...
Sure. Well, and it's also in the interest of supporting the what it means to maintain right structures. So the First Unitarian Society and Taliesin Preservation will gain from that activity as well.
So if you'd like to learn some more and maybe sign up for this event on Saturday, August 20th, just coming up this Saturday, from 11 to 4, I hope you'll go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. There'll be a spot there where you can click to learn more and also to sign up. Ben in Black River Falls, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Ben.
Hi there. Hey, back in 1969-70, in that long winter, I was 12 years old, and we rented Tawny Dairy on the Taliesin grounds at a time when the fellowship was trying to keep the homes occupied through the winters because of the decay that they were experiencing. I learned to really love Frank Lloyd Wright during that time and had a chance to basically live on Taliesin. A couple of problems. One, I thought that Frank Lloyd Wright, at least at that period, was designing to scale because I was constantly striking my head on all the doorways. And secondly, I don't think he ever cooked a meal in his life because the kitchens were kind of an afterthought to the rest of the house. But the concern I had is I read recently that Tawny Dairy has reached a point of decay where they're working hard to get it renovated again. It was one of his earlier places. It was very pretty. Not a very complex house, but very pretty. And it was also historically an important point because that's where his wife was laid out after the horrible disaster at Taliesin. I just wanted to know whether there are any plans currently for continuing repair to that building and the other ones on the estate.
Thank you, Ben, for calling. And Sid, do you comment?
Absolutely. In fact, this summer has been a very significant effort working on Tawny Dairy. It has several functions on the Taliesin estate now. It is placed for a couple of students at the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture to live during their summer season here in Wisconsin. It is a place for guests who come to be at Taliesin or at the school. And we're working very hard right now. We're installing some heating and cooling features that will allow the house to be extended over the calendar year. And it has turned out to be a really important effort for both a group of about a half a dozen students who have been really putting their shoulder to the wheel and their shovel in the ground to renovate this building. It has a status that requires some real care in terms of its historic significance, but there are ways and places within the house where we can introduce some of these other appliances and facilities that will not destroy the significance of its history, but will certainly increase its lifespan and its usability.
And Ben's comment about cracking his head on the door jams and also the kitchen.
Yes. Okay. Well, Tawny Dairy has undergone some really significant changes of use over time. So I'm not quite sure which form of kitchen he may have experienced. It were reworking that as well at that time. Wright had some very definite ideas of the way he thought people ought to do things, and whether they wanted to do them that way or not was another matter, of course. The question of ceiling heights is one that always comes up, and it's a very interesting one. Yes, there are low ceilings. It would be general to say that they don't occur in the major spaces. And in a sense, he always wanted you to enter, I won't say bowing your head quite, but the idea would be that you prepare for an architectural experience by going through a gate, so to speak. And that gate tended to be a little low. And then when you entered the major room, then the space would open up, and that sense of expansion was part of his way of building.
Reed in Wyoming Valley, we turn to you next. Hi, Reed.
Hi. I'm actually at the Wyoming Valley School that Mr. Wright designed, the only elementary school, I guess, that he designed, and it's just been reopened as a cultural center. But what I wanted to comment about was when I was a graduate student at the university, I happened in on a conference. It was 2 years after Mr. Wright's death, and someone was giving a wonderful lecture demonstration of how Frank Lloyd Wright had been influenced by Louis Salton, primarily the Japanese. Well, the next fellow who got up was livid. He said Frank Lloyd Wright was not influenced by the Japanese, by Louis Salton. If he'd been born in the Stone Age, he would have developed the Usonian house, which I thought was very, very interesting to think that he was not influenced by anyone. And I also came across an old friend where I was doing a performance, and he went, "What's wrong?" I said, "Spring Green." He said, "Oh, you know, I used to lay stone walls for Mr. Wright's aunts, and they would say to us, 'It grows out of the ground, boys. It
goes out of the ground.'" You're breaking up, Reed, unfortunately. Comments in?
Well, I'm very glad that Reed brought this question of sources up, because it's one that can be, I think, misunderstood in a number of ways. There is no question that Frank Lloyd Wright, and in fact, Olga Vanna, his last wife, made this observation, that he had the capacity to absorb whatever he looked at or read with very quickly. And I think the phrase that I've come to develop with respect to historical architecture is that for Frank Lloyd Wright, history was not credential, but nutrient. He did not wear his historical knowledge to prove that he was a good architect. The proof was how he interpreted it. And there's no question that when Frank Lloyd Wright went to Japan, his comment was he found confirmation in Japan, which can be heard as arrogant, but I don't think it is, because in a sense, you could only really understand Japan if you were prepared to. And Wright had prepared himself. So when he actually got to Japan, he was able to use that source and that interpretive material in a very powerful way without in any way copying it. I mean, there were certain principles. He always talked about his architecture as an architecture of principle, not of effects. And so he was very aware of looking at a form or a precedent and interpreting it rather than copying it.
Thank you again, Reed, for calling. Judith in Milwaukee, we're turning to you. Hi, Judith.
Hi. It was the mention of falling water that prompted me to call. In the 1980s, I wrote for the Milwaukee Journal, and I did a story on the Pew House in Madison, which at that point changed hands for the first time. The original owner sold the house. And I had the opportunity to talk with Wesley Peters, Frank Lloyd Wright's son-in-law, who worked with him on many of his projects. And he quoted Frank Lloyd Wright as saying, Wesley Peters asked Frank Lloyd Wright, "Mr. Wright, is the Pew House a poor man's falling water?" And Mr. Wright said, "No, Wes. Falling water is a rich man's pew house." Which I thought was just lovely.
Sid?
Exactly. That is a wonderful story. And it really fits into our notion of Frank Lloyd Wright and democracy, because He really thought that the world started at the base and worked its way up rather than starting at the top and trickling its way down. And Falling Water was a kind of culmination, whether it was the Pew House or Frank Lloyd Wright also used Taliesin as a precedent for Taliesin, the way the Taliesin projects off of the hillside, not over a waterfall, but there was a commonality in his interpretation. And I think the thing that makes both of those comparisons interesting is that they're both wooden houses, and Falling Water is all concrete, reinforced concrete. And so in a sense, he was able to do things with reinforced concrete that he was unable to have done earlier on with just wooden studs and board and batten siding.
Yeah, interesting. Judith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Ron in Cloquet, Minnesota, on to you. Hi, Ron.
Hi. My comment and question is, first off, we have a gas station that Frank Lloyd Wright designed in the middle of our town. And over the years, it's pretty much has been deteriorating. It's still a working gas station. But my question is how many structures do we lose annually, Frank Lloyd Wright, and how many have we lost? I'll take myself off the air.
All right.
Sure. That's a wonderful question and a difficult one because absolute destruction doesn't happen all that often. There have been fires. I can think of a house in South Bend, Indiana that recently disappeared. There are ways of intervening in a piece of architecture aside from pure destruction, and certainly some houses have suffered from either decay or additions and, shall we say, corrections over time that make it a question of whether it remains a Frank Lloyd Wright building or not. There is an organization called the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy with its organizational headquarters in Chicago that is specifically dedicated to monitoring the existence of Wright buildings and helping out when possible if an owner needs a little advice in terms of how to manage a structural problem or whatever. And so there is an organization that is dedicated specifically to answering that question and try to make sure that they don't disappear.
Thank you again. And Sid, thank you for being with us today. I just want to remind everybody that this Saturday, August 20th, from 11 to 4 in Madison, you have a chance to participate in Democracy in the Architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. That's the title. And you'll have a chance to visit the First Unitarian Society's Landmark Meeting House, the Wright's Jacob Usonian House, the Marshall Erdman House that Wright used as the basis for his prefab number 3, along with an opening lecture by Sid and
Michael Schuller.
And then a closing panel after you have the tour to talk about the work that Wright did. And they synthesize the sites and offering some insights, more insights into the theme. And you can find out more and get registered for it by going to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can click there and get yourself involved in that event this Saturday. Sid, thank you again.
Thank you, Larry.
Sidney Robinson is an architect. He works with Taliesin Preservation Incorporated. He's an emeritus professor of architecture at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Pleasure to have him on. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Sure. Thank you.
I'd love to have you back. We'll talk some more about Frank Lloyd Wright. We're switching gears, though, and talking with an old friend, Victoria Houston, who is the author of several mystery books, I guess we could call them the Loon Lake Fishing Mystery Series. She's got a new book out called Dead Deceiver, and we'll talk about that with her next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.